Well, I was going to talk about the doldrums, but first of all, you need to know what the doldrums are, and the doldrums will be explained in this way, in a very physical way. At the equator, there's a region of ocean in which there are light and variable winds and slow ocean currents. This belt is also known as the intertropical convergence zone. I guess if you're a meteorologist, that's what you would call it. And this is where the northeast and southeast trade winds meet. I gave you a little diagram to point that out in your handout. And this produces very slow air movement, and that means that there's dead calms prevalent about one-third of the time. And this band of air stagnation is called the doldrums. And it's often a region also that produces heavy rains because there's a great amount of condensation that forms because of all the warm, moist air. The doldrums also refers to the depressed mental state that overtook crews of sailing vessels for centuries that were trapped there perhaps for days or weeks as they were trying to get through that band there, that intertropical convergence zone. Now, obviously, if you're fully dependent on the wind for motion and there isn't any wind, you're stuck. You're caught in the doldrums. And so sailing around the world is very similar to sailing the seas of life. Sometimes you've got good, strong currents and good, healthy winds, and sometimes you're in the dead calm where things just don't seem to be happening. And it's a period of seeming inactivity. And those times can be frustrating and even depressing, especially when you watch other people who are on fire and full of zeal and productivity and all kinds of things are happening in their lives. And you're looking at your life and you're going, nothing's really happening right now. No one grows at the same speed forever. Even nature shows inconsistency in that. I was going to put up a picture of tree rings, but I think you've all seen tree rings. If you've ever cut open a tree and cut firewood, you see that sometimes those rings are very wide apart. Those are periods of great growth. Nature was kind to that tree, right? And there was great sunlight and water and all sorts of things. But then there's other times when the bands are very narrow. Those are lean years. Times of lesser growth. So you see in the same tree, periods of great growth and periods of lesser growth. And that's really what we're talking about in the human context here. There is an inconsistency in our movement, in our growth. I'm not making excuse for inactivity, and I'm not describing treading water like you're ready to fail or anything like that. Christians are always to be on the move. Sometimes we move faster than we do at other times, however. And that's just really being honest about the situation. And it happens to the best of us. I don't know that anyone ever escapes it entirely. In fact, if you're going through this period of time right now, I want you to take courage. If you are in Christ, there is hope. If you're not in Christ, well, there is hope, but a decision has to be made. Last week, we talked about what it takes to motivate you. And there we talked about you need to get your value centered and right. You need to have the right value at your core. And if Christ is your value center and your soul's best interest is right there with Christ, then you will desire those things and you'll be motivated to act. This week, we're not talking about being unmotivated because of a value conflict. Now we're talking about the fact that you are human, and being human, you are susceptible to human weakness. That's our lesson this morning. Now, if you look at a dictionary version or definition of the doldrums, it will say something along the lines of what Webster says, a period of low spirits and sluggishness. It will probably go on to say that it could last for days or weeks or even months, sometimes even years. And that's hard to reconcile with, you know, these verses of, you know, great admonitions like we see in Romans 12, verse 11, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, talking about verses here that we're supposed to be filled with zeal and we're supposed to excel still more. And it makes it look like that the New Testament doesn't make any provision for being human almost like we're some superhuman, you know, machine that is just, once we're set in motion, we're kind of like a juggernaut, right? We just keep going and we never stop. We never slow down. We're just always pressing forward, and we never have any periods of rejuvenation or rest or anything like that. And if you do, by the way, if you do need those periods, then you must have weakness of faith, because otherwise you wouldn't be slowing down at all. It seems like it says that at times. And maybe this is the fault of preachers too, who seem to preach that at times. And yet there are times, when enthusiasm and ambition sags or droops, and your get up and go kind of got up and went. I think all of us have probably experienced that. And there comes with that a general despondency. I'm not talking here about, you know, an actual clinical depression or anything like that. But I think all of us can appreciate what it means to just be, you know, despondent or down, if you will, for a period of time. And we're not talking about people who are uninterested in the gospel or insincere or have lost their faith. They've just lost their present energy, or maybe they're struggling with their drive or their inertia there. And in fact, really what this is, it's not an engine problem. The engine's working fine. It's a transmission problem. And I'll explain that more when I go along in this lesson. So if you know anything about cars, you know that it has an engine and a transmission. Some of you are like, and that's all I need to know right there. Okay? And that's fine. But this is not a motor problem, like your motor gave out. That's a big problem. Transmission problem has to do with shifting gears from one phase or stage to another. We'll talk about that, like I said. This is like getting stuck in first gear on I-5, okay? Your engine's working just fine, but your transmission is not working just fine. Something's not shifting here. And it's not the same as apathy or indifference, because these are much bigger problems than what we're talking about. Indifference means I'm not committed to either choice, whether I'm faithful or not. I don't, you know, I'm not really committed either way. Apathy says I just don't care one way or the other, or I just don't care at all. And there are people, sadly, Christians, who become indifferent and even apathetic. And that's a far more serious problem than what we're talking about. But I will say that when you go through these periods of sluggishness, you do start to wonder, how long is this going to last? Is this going to be this way forever? What if I can't get out? It's kind of like being caught in an eddy on a river. If you've ever done any of that, I used to go inner tubing down a river. I couldn't swim very well at all. It was the dumbest thing in my life to do. And I never had a life jacket on. And one time I did get caught in an eddy, and I got pretty scared because I couldn't get out. I mean, I was young and strong at the time, and still young and strong. But anyway, but I was frantically trying to get out of that thing. And I had those feelings of, what if I can't get out of this thing? And it's kind of sucking you down into the river. Or, you know, the if you've ever had Meniere's disease or any kind of balance issues, Mike, right? You and I were just talking about that. I've suffered from balance issues. In fact, I've lost all balance in my left side. I had to go through balance therapy to get it back. So I understand what that's like. And when you're laying on a bed and your whole world's spinning in front of you or all around you and you can't move, you start to wonder, is this going to be how it is from this point on? Or if you've got writer's block, if any of you happen to be a writer, maybe not. Okay, well, I do write books, so I understand writer's block. When you're sitting there and you're just staring at a blank page and you're supposed to write a chapter or even a page or even a paragraph and you can't get anything out. Now, a couple days ago, you could write 6 pages in a single sitting, right? Through a 16-ounce Americano, you could get 6 pages out. Done it. But then the next day or the next week, you just can't even get a paragraph, and it's hard to get a sentence out. Some lessons, for example, you know, they write themselves. I just sit there, and my hand just kind of goes, and, you know, they just write themselves. And other times, I can't get a single point down on paper, seems like. So I understand what that's like, and maybe you do too. And you fight to do or struggle to do what days or weeks ago was natural and easy. You have a great desire to move forward, but you can't get traction. And then you have feelings of depression that come with that. You can't seem to tap into or engage the creative mind because it's like it's disengaged from you. It's not like you lost it altogether, but you can't access it, at least for a period of time. Ironically, doldrums tend to follow times of great effort and achievement. As in all aspects of life, there are peaks and then there are valleys, and then there are peaks again and then more valleys. We'll talk about that in a moment here. When you expend a great amount of energy to overcome something, to succeed at something, you have perhaps sometimes a tremendous letdown afterward. I've experienced this personally every Monday. Mondays are really bad for me mentally because I go through a great amount of adrenaline and you know, build up for lessons and classes and Sundays and everything like that. And then Monday comes along and it's like, boom. And I feel like I can't do anything mentally. And it's frustrating. And I've talked to other preachers. They say oftentimes the same things because we're human. We're going through a very human thing. A very human process here. It's similar to when you have great exertion of adrenaline. If you've ever been, you're driving along and someone gets in a car accident, and you go to help them, and you know the adrenaline kicks in, and you're ripping off doors and pulling people out of cars or whatever you do, and then afterward you sit down, you start shaking, and you just can't seem to do anything. It's because you had just expended a great amount of energy and now your body is saying, okay, we gotta stop. We just can't do that forever. And so if you think about that, this is what we're talking about. A classic case of that is Elijah in 1 Kings 19. He's confronted Ahab, the king of Israel, and then the whole situation with Mount Carmel, the prophets of Baal, you can read about in 1 Kings 18 there. And it says that he ran for his life in chapter 19, verse 3, from Jezebel, Ahab's wicked wife, who was seeking to kill him and had already killed a whole bunch of prophets. So she wasn't just talk. And he goes out into the wilderness and he sits down out there and he says, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take my life. You got to wonder if this guy isn't going through what we might call the doldrums. That he's just expended a great amount of energy trying to eradicate Baalism from Israel and trying to escape for his life. And now his body is just saying, and his mind is there too, is just saying, yeah, we got to stop. Can't keep doing this. I wonder if it's possible that we could consider other cases. I'm not going to be dogmatic on this. I'm not going to say that this is what they were going through. But the indications are there that David, in 2 Samuel 11, he had just finished this massive and very successful military campaign, a great exertion of energy on his part, and then he just stays back from one of the campaigns, and he's there in his other state of mind here. And that's when he gets all messed up with Bathsheba. I'm going to talk about that here in just a minute, why that might have been the case. John the Baptist had just preached approximately 6 months of a very intense ministry. Then he was arrested by King Herod. He sat in his prison cell and he sent word to Jesus with his own disciples. And they say to Jesus, are you the chosen one or should we be looking for someone else? Here he had this great ministry, this great campaign, if you will, and then now he's sitting in a jail cell wondering if he had made a great mistake. Someone going through the doldrums, possibly. Jesus himself had great favor with the multitudes early in his ministry. In fact, if you look at his early ministries in all the Gospels, a great popularity, great followings, and great receptions, and so on. But then things start to change. And after he visits Nazareth, he gets a very poor reception. And then right after that, there's the death of John the Baptist. He is beheaded by Herod. Keep in mind that Jesus and John were probably cousins. So there's a family relation there, as well as Jesus's, deep connection with John in his ministry. In Matthew chapter 14, verse 13, it says, now when Jesus heard it, that is the death of John the Baptist, he withdrew from there in a boat to a lonely place by himself. Well, what was he doing there? Regrouping? Dealing with his human side? Possibly going through the doldrums? We know in Matthew 26, 41, it says, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Sometimes the flesh is willing, but it's the spirit that is weak. Weak in the sense of it just needs to regroup and rejuvenate and just get back to where it was. And I'm saying this kind of tongue-in-cheek. I'm not saying it's always that way, but I'm just saying that it does seem to be that way. And you can't just ignore this problem, because the doldrums make you vulnerable to deeper frustration. And then what you do is you become susceptible to what's called cynicism. And cynicism is when you just stop caring about anything. You basically lose faith in everything and everyone. Cynics are people who have an extremely pessimistic view of the world, because they feel like the whole world's a problematic, and people are part of the world, and so they're problematic, and the only people that are good in the world are themselves. And that's just an awful place to be. Jaded scorn would be a good description of cynicism, a loss of faith, a withering of one's conviction. And if you're in that condition for too long, then it's possible to grow sour on religion and start frowning upon Christianity, and yes, lose your faith and even fall away. Falling away does not happen in a weekend or in a day. It's a process. But it's a process of a slow drift away from those sayings. And part of that slow drift may be because of this despondency that we're talking about called the doldrums. And those who are frustrated with being stuck in first gear, spiritually speaking, in their life, they may seek stimulation and fulfillment elsewhere. And they start seeking escapism, giving their energy and their attention to their feelings and their earthly pleasures as a replacement for their spiritual despondency. I would offer the idea that that's possibly what happened with David. After this great military campaign, very great success and so on, and then there is this incident with Bathsheba. So all the military campaign was for the benefit of Israel, following God's commands, etc. Bathsheba was a personal thing. And it was a fill-in, basically. Trying to fill in something that he thought was missing there. As I said, the doldrums should be something temporary, even though it's frustrating. It should be a temporary situation, a minor setback, an incidental phase. In my opinion, and it's just my opinion, it's actually a limited but often undiagnosed form of grieving. We have these little deaths in our life, and I don't mean that anyone's actually died. It's not that. It's little deaths are transitions from one big project or one season of life to the other. You have to leave the old season behind and go to the new one. But in the process, you grieve over what's lost. It's kind of like getting from innocence as a child into teenagehood and then adulthood. You're leaving behind different seasons of life in the process. And there is some grieving in those processes. Leaving behind an old friend, making a move to another place, leaving an old job, leaving an old car that you've been fond of for years. I had a little grieving over leaving Ralphie. That was the name of my red pickup that I had to sell in order to get my other one. So you're wondering right now, why does anyone call his pickup Ralphie? That's a long story, and I'm not going to tell it. But Larissa is to blame. So I feel this, again, as a writer. When I finish a book, it's a great sense of accomplishment. But then there's just this little death, you know, like now I have to move on to another book or another project. And there's that transitioning from one thing to another. I think nearly everyone faces this, but it doesn't mean that everyone deals with that or grief in the same way. If your faith is strong, you tend to work through this naturally. I'm not saying that you do it unconsciously, but you tend to work through it naturally. In other words, it's not a big upset. Just like me on Mondays, you know, it's not like I'm losing my faith every Monday and then I get it back on Tuesday. It's just I got to work through this naturally. And I'll tell you in the next lesson what works for me to get back more quickly than not. Sailors that were caught in the doldrums in that band around the equator there, and then caught in that rain, and then caught in that depression, they did get out. It was just a matter of time. And they had to learn to wait. They had to learn not to give up. I don't have any accounts that I've come across where the sailors just all jumped overboard and just ended it all because they were in the doldrums. They just had to wait it out. They knew what was happening to them. The human spirit is unable to sustain a high energy output forever or indefinitely. It needs a break. Not only does your body need a break, but neither is, but your spirit rather should also have a break, so long as that break doesn't become a lifestyle. You need to recognize what is happening to you, is what I'm saying. Some people do make a career out of their stagnation, and then they use their, I'm just so depressed, and this is not a clinical depression, this is just a euphemism, for I'm kind of bored, or I'm kind of lazy, or I've lost my value system, like we talked about last week, and they use that as a crutch and a platform. We're not talking about those people. We're not talking about that situation here. It is possible that doldrums is God's way of keeping us humble. In other words, we have limits, we have pitfalls, we have dead spots. Sometimes we are in dead calm, and that makes us human. And when we see things like that that makes us human, then we're reminded of our humanity. In other words, we are not, you know, this powerful machine that just goes on and on forever, indefinitely. Rather, we have weaknesses, we have inadequacies, we have deficiencies. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, you see some of that where Paul is addressing his own weakness. And God is saying, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. What God's saying to Paul is, my power is perfected in your weakness. And so Paul's response is, therefore, most gladly, I will boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Boast about our weaknesses. That doesn't mean that you're going around bragging that you're weak, but rather that you're understanding that you're weak, and that even though I'm weak, God can still work through me, even through my weaknesses. And I will propose to you that even if you are in the doldrums, even right now as we speak, God can still work through you in your weakness. You just need to learn how to let Him do that. When we're tackling a demanding schedule or overcoming some temptation or confronting, dealing with adversity, it's easy to take credit for ourselves and our accomplishments and our achievements, to put all the emphasis on our effort and to say things like, look at what I have done. Look at what I have overcome. I went through this great ordeal and I came out unscathed and intact, and you know, and all these things that we might say about ourselves. Now, none of that necessarily is put into actual words, but it's stuff that we believe in our heart. Look at what I have done. And then it's as if God allows us to get the wind knocked out of our sails, so that we will recognize that we are not strong enough to sustain ourselves perpetually. And I'm not suggesting that God pushes us deliberately into dead calm, but He may allow us to be there nonetheless, not to destroy us, but rather to force us to come to terms with what's really going on here. To recognize where the true source of spiritual strength is. A lot of people quote this verse, Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. In my strong opinion, it's often misunderstood, because what a lot of people think this means is, I can choose whatever ministry I want for God and Christ will give me the strength to do it. That's not what Paul is saying at all. What Paul is saying is, whatever God wants me to do, He will also strengthen me to do it. He's the one doing the choosing. He's the one assigning the ministries and so on. So we're not just doing things with His permission. We're actually acting by or through His strength. And this is where we need to recognize ourselves as followers of Christ, that we do have a certain amount of human strength, and we'll use that to God's glory, but He has greater strength than us, and we need that strength desperately in order to do what we do. 2 Corinthians, by the way, is an excellent New Testament book to read on this subject, because you see Paul essentially getting the wind knocked out of him. He has worked so hard and done so much and endured so much and suffered so much for God's people, for the gospel itself, for the cause of Christ. And then he's got these people that keep coming on and antagonizing him, and they claim to be Christians, but really they're just people that want to make him miserable. And they're telling the church at Corinth, hey, don't listen to Paul. Paul doesn't know what he's talking about. We have greater insight and knowledge than Paul. We're at least as smart as Paul, if not smarter, and that you don't really need Paul. Just listen to us. And Corinth is going, yeah, maybe we should listen to these guys. And Paul's coming back and going, what is your problem? I paraphrase a lot of that. So the Judaizers, the Christians who, Jews rather, who became Christians but are trying to impose Judaism, law of Moses stuff, on the converts, the Gentile converts, they gave Paul a great amount of grief. And if you look at 2 Corinthians, if you want to turn there, I'm going to be looking at a few verses. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, starting in verse 5. And Paul says here, for even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without, fears within. But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus, who, by the way, brought very good news about Corinth's reception of Paul's first letter that he had sent them, which Paul was agonizing over there. Have you ever felt like that? Conflicts without, fears within. If you have, then you know what Paul was talking about, at least on a human level. You see what he was saying there. Maybe there's someone going through that even right now. Conflicts within, fears without. In other words, internal conflicts, struggling, self-struggling, you know, trying to get things resolved within, but then there's external things going on as well. It's not like you're living in a vacuum where externally everything's perfect. Because it's not. So you're dealing with both sides or both spheres of your life internally as well as externally. And God is credited with leading Paul out of that despondency. And so instead of disconnecting and retreating into the shadows and succumbing to weariness and even cynicism, he leans instead on God. If you back up in the chapter 4, and if you look at verse 7 through 11, he talks about this difficulty he's facing here. He says in verse 7, we have this treasure in earthen vessels so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. In other words, this ministry is not ours, and we recognize that. But we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always caring about the body of the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our body. For we are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake. You think about the mindset or the state of mind of what he is going through. This is not a man who is having a good time. A man who is struggling with what he's been asked to do. And he knows that it's going to turn out for good because he trusts in the God who has given him the assignment. But along the way, there are going to be struggles. There are going to be great peaks, and then there are going to be great valleys. And who gets them out of the valleys? If you read down into verse 16 here, the few verses later, he says, therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, our inner man is being renewed day by day. We tend to take that verse by itself. In other words, we don't consider the mindset of Paul or the state of mind of Paul at the time when he wrote that. We just kind of look at that verse like, okay, so our outer body is decaying and our inner body needs to be renewed day by day. We just look at it as a subject. But you've got to look at it in connection to what Paul just said. We're going through some really difficult times here. But our mind is being renewed day by day. And the question they'll be asking here is, renewed by whom or by what? Because Paul is not capable of renewing himself. That renewal comes to him through God. Now, it's based upon or conditioned by his faith in God. It's true. In other words, it's not happening apart from his faith, but because of his faith, he is being renewed. He's being buoyed, if you will. He's being rejuvenated. And it's very similar to what you see there in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, where it says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Keep in mind, it's the same writer writing both texts here. God is not telling you to renew yourself. If you could do that, then you don't need God. And by the way, that's a very salvation by works mentality, to think that you can renew yourself apart from God, for God, and that you don't really need his help at all. How should we say that? Good luck with that. Because that's not going to help you. And it's a very arrogant and presumptuous theology. And yet a lot of Christians, sadly, succumb to that. What he's really saying is, trust him who has the power to refuel and renew and rejuvenate your human soul. I realize other people can help with encouragement and so on. In fact, we're told to do that. And we're not discounting that. We're just focusing on the big picture here. And that is that when your soul goes through one of those valleys, when your mind goes through one of those valleys, trust in God to lift you out of that valley. It's really what we're saying here. You are human. And your energy and your stamina and your ability to sustain yourself is limited. You cannot walk for long without tiring. You cannot race without resting. You cannot be on fire indefinitely. I'm not giving you permission to be mediocre here. But at the same time, we're just being realistic. On the other hand, God is a God of limitless energy and strength and stamina. It doesn't matter how much energy God gives, he is never depleted from what he had to begin with. This violates natural laws, by the way. Laws of thermodynamics say if there's energy that is expended, then that means there's a depletion in the source. But in this case, with a God who has boundless, limitless, infinite energy, he can expend great amounts of energy and still have 100% energy that he had to start with. And that's, you know, mind-blowing when you start thinking about that. So as we read in Isaiah chapter 40, he is never tired. He is never weary. He is never sapped. He's never drained. He is not like you or me. He is infinitely better than you and me. He is stronger than us. He is more resourceful than us. And this is key, he is not trapped in your situation. So when you're going through one of those valleys and those doldrums or despondency or whatever you want to call it there, he is not trapped in that. It's not like God is going through a despondency too. Like he's going through, you know, a depression of sorts. God is aware of our limitations, but he wants us to be aware of them too. But he also wants us to be aware that he is unlimited and therefore is able to lift us up and sustain us and, may I use the word, even infuse us or enthuse us. By the way, that word enthuse or enthusiasm literally means to put God into something. Literally what the word means. I don't think anyone knows that, but that's where it comes from in Latin. I want to be clear, we're not talking about the big footprints poem here, you know, which is so popular, and there's like 2 billion memes on internet, I found out, that talk about that. You know, the footprints poem where it says that, you know, this man was walking and there are 2 footprints on the beach, and then there is sometimes one set, and the man saying, God, how come you abandoned me? And God saying, no, I didn't abandon you. That was when I was carrying you. And we all go, aw. That sounds so cool. And it's completely missing from Scripture. Not the poem, but the idea. I don't read anywhere where God picks me up and carries me without allowing me to walk on my own 2 feet. I do see a lot of places where God says, get up, stand up, and walk on your own 2 feet. As we see on the screen here, God does not carry you, but he does give you the strength to walk. And he'll do all kinds of things for you in order for you to walk. But he expects you to do the walking. There should always be 2 sets of footprints. So the poem is sentimental and people get sucked into that sort of thing. But that's not really accurate. We are only as strong as our own strength. And when that strength is depleted or subdued or stalled, then it forces our acknowledgement of his strength. And what that forcing of that acknowledgement is called is humility, which is really what we need here. Now I'm going to turn the whole doldrum side on its head here and see doldrums as a time of transition, as a lull before the storm. We were talking about the lull after the storm earlier, but now we're going to talk about the lull before the storm. And so, in other words, intense activity can be preceded by this lull. Maybe you need that time to recharge for what's coming. And this usually occurs when you've exhausted the zeal and enthusiasm of one stage and you're ready to ascend to another stage. We talked about Elijah earlier here. Elijah had work to do. He just didn't know he had to do it. And he needed that time, perhaps, to sit there and have a little pity party in the cave for a while and to, you know, kind of feel sorry for himself and everything else. And then God finally says, I've got work for you. It's kind of like a rocket burning through the fuel in different stages. If you know anything about rocketry, and I'm no rocket scientist, but I do know that rockets have different stages and that one burns off, the fuel section burns off, and then it leaves the rocket and it moves on to another stage. So it requires a new stage, but the old one had to be depleted first. And that's what I'm talking about here. Or it's like shifting gears. And if you know anything about manual transmission, and people are like, manual transmission, what is that? Okay, back in the day, you used to have to push in a clutch and actually shift gears to make the car go. Okay? Some of you know what I'm talking about? The whole idea, the concept of the transmission in the shifting is that at some point, the engine has to be separated from the transmission in order for the shifting to occur. So when you're pushing in the clutch, you're actually disengaging the engine and transmission momentarily in order to go up to a higher gear. Do you see what I'm talking about? In other words, there's that lull. It might be small comparatively, but it's there nonetheless. Now suppose you just went driving down the road on I-5 and you're shifting from, say, fourth gear to fifth gear, but you just push in the clutch and you shift into fifth gear, but you never push or let off on the clutch. Now you're disengaged, and what's going to happen over time? You're just going to start slowing down because your engine's still running just great and your transmission is in the right place, but it's disengaged. It's a transmission problem. So you can't do that. That's why I said that you can't be in the doldrums for the rest of your life, because all you're going to do is slow down and then stop. So you're just using the doldrums then as a shifting gear sort of idea here. Those who are sensitive to spiritual elevation are also typically very sensitive to spiritual despondency. What I just said there was that if you're really attuned to a spiritual high level of enthusiasm and understanding and insight and so on, you are also going to be very much aware of when that is down in a valley, because you're just kind of wired that way. Intense passion and exuberance can be followed by intense restlessness and seeming paralysis. Often the lows, are prior to the next burst. Again, we have peaks and valleys, but then we have peaks again. And maybe that second peak is higher than the other one. New stage, new phase, need to rest, need to work up to what is coming. We see that in Acts chapter 18, for example, really 17 and 18, where Paul went to Athens and he had very poor reception. In a very difficult time there in Athens, he preached there, but very few converts, very little was done. And then he comes to Corinth, and what's the first thing he does is he's kind of intimidated by the situation. He goes back to tent making for a little bit. And then, Jesus has to appear to him and say, there's no one that's going to harm you in this city, basically saying, I need you to get busy now. You've had your downtime. I need you to get busy because I've got a lot of people that I need you to talk to. And he spends a year and a half of intense activity in Corinth. So he goes to Athens and, you know, there's that peak and what he expected things, but they didn't turn out really well. And so he goes down this lull and when he gets to Corinth, but then in Corinth, there's this greater peak and great success. And I would like to propose to you that Paul needed that lull in order to be ready for that next peak. And because he saw it, he appreciated it. And so there was this great work that had to be done. Not everyone does ascend. Sometimes people just fall downward because they're depressed and disillusioned and overly frustrated for way too long. Satan looks for those people, by the way. Satan looks for Christians who are in the doldrums because they become easy targets. They can become very vulnerable. And you think about what Satan whispers to those people in their ear, so to speak. It's like, you're not really cut out for this. You don't really believe all this stuff, do you? I mean, if you were a man or a woman of God, God wouldn't be letting you down by letting you feel this way and letting you feel periods of despondency. He would just jack you up all the time. You don't really need all these people. You don't really need all that teaching. You could just do all these things on your own. And then Paul reminds us in Ephesians 4:27, do not give the devil an opportunity. It really doesn't matter what the case is that he's talking about there. He's talking about anger, but in any case, do not give the devil an opportunity. We're not saying it's a sin to experience the doldrums, because it's not. Because likely you will experience it, and it's human to experience it. On the other hand, we are saying, do not choose to remain in the doldrums, and do not indulge those negative feelings, because Satan is looking for people like you when you do that. Some feel that it's the church's responsibility to rescue us all out of our doldrums. And that's why churches have socials and charismatic preachers and pick-me-ups, all kinds of different pick-me-ups. It's really not the congregation's responsibility for our own enthusiasm or our own state of mind. I do believe the congregation should contribute positively to those things, of course. But it can't take responsibility for who you are or even where you are or what you're going through. I will say conspicuously, might be a lesson like this, by the way, which is a work of this congregation, that might be exactly what you needed to hear. While I or we are not removing your responsibility, we can certainly help you bear that responsibility. We're told to do that in Galatians 6:2. We're not going to take your cross from you. But we can help you bear your cross if you let us. Are you caught in the doldrums right now? Don't say things like, well, if I get out. Just say things like, well, when I get out. God will not allow you to be overwhelmed or to have too much. The doldrums can be looked at as just another opportunity for faith building. Because you have to believe and trust that you will make it through, and God will be there to do that. He'll make it through, not just with you, but he will be the reason why you make it through. Doldrums, by the way, doesn't just affect individual people. It can affect groups of people as well. It can affect entire congregations. In my strong opinion, even since I've been here, we have gone through the doldrums here. I don't want to get into that historically right now. But I do think it can face an entire group. We have to remember who commands the winds and the currents and the storms. God brought a storm for Jonah, but Jesus calmed the storm. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Isn't that what Job learned there? Or at least what he said there? He is always there to help, never to harm us. Jesus Christ is a shepherd, but he's also a pilot. You cannot think that when you're going through the doldrums that he's left you by, that he doesn't care, that he's just passed you along like, oh, if you can't keep up, I don't need you kind of thing. Valleys have dark shade and predators, and yet we have a shepherd who leads us through the valleys. The wilderness has heat and dust and discomfort, and yet we have a host who provides a feast in the midst of it all. Oceans have dead spots and frustration, and yet we have a pilot who navigates us through those times. Life is filled with difficulty and turmoil and heartache and sometimes even tragedy, and yet we have a Redeemer who saves us from it all. The doldrums may be God's way of telling you something, that you cannot run with endurance the race that is set before you on your own power indefinitely. Or you cannot run at your own speed. Or you cannot run at your own schedule. But you do need to run. And you need to do it with his strength. I like what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:10, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And I think that sums up really where every Christian should be. By the grace of God, I can do this. I am what I am, and I'll do what I do, and I'll live how I live for the Lord. By the grace of God, we will make it to heaven, but not by our own strength. Next week, I will offer suggestions for getting out of the doldrums. Again, not by yourself, but with God's help. But we had to explain what the doldrums are, because me telling you how to get out of them won't have any value to you if you don't know how you got into them. So we'll deal with that next week. I hope this lesson has been helpful. Hope it's been even slightly educational, inspirational perhaps. There is hope. Even in our darkest hours, there is hope. If there's anyone that needs to respond to our lesson this morning, this will be your time to do so as we stand and sing the song that has been selected for us.